Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Almost everyone with interest in the Vietnam War recalls the My Lai massacre, when U.S. troops slaughtered more than 500 civilians in one village. It took a few good men to stop the slaughter that day, and one man eventually was convicted of war crimes for it. But there were another 500 or more allegations of atrocities during the war that were never seriously investigated. In his new book, journalist and historian Nick Terse reviews a litany of slaughters and also brings into focus the policy behind the actions. His book is called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick Terse is with us today now by phone from New Jersey. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So it's tough to begin any discussion about this topic without the context of My Lai and its relevance in the day. It was horrific by any measure. The point is that it wasn't isolated.
That's right. And this is something that I discovered when I was a graduate student. And I happened to be in the National Archives. I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans. And I was down there trying to match up self-report material that we had on veterans service with hard data in the National Archives. And it was about 2 weeks of research that I'd done, and I just hit a dead end. Every research avenue that I pursued was a failure. And I went to an archivist that I normally worked with, and I told him, you know, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I need at least a lead, something to come back with. And he said a couple words to me that changed my life. He said, do you think that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress? And I said, you know, that's an excellent hypothesis. What do you have on war crimes? And he told me about a group of records called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group Files. And he said they'd been sitting down in the archives basement for years. And, I told him, you know, let me take a look. He pulled the records for me. And within an hour, I was searching through box after box of hundreds of reports made by active duty GIs and recently returned veterans about what they had witnessed firsthand in Vietnam. And to call it a treasure trove of information is the wrong phrase. It was really a horror trove. We're talking about reports on massacres, murder, mutilation, torture, rape, assault. It really painted a horrific picture, and I realized pretty quickly that that these records weren't anywhere in the existing literature.
Is the first thing you thought of My Lai, that I thought that was the only thing that really happened, that really went wrong over there? Did you have the same reaction that a lot of people do?
Well, I had been I'd been researching the war for some time by that point, so I knew that when I looked at these cases, they looked to me like the types of things that the so-called winter soldiers said when they came back. There were anti-war veterans who were speaking out in the wake of My Lai, who were saying that that My Lai wasn't an aberration, that this wasn't an isolated incident, even though a lot of times it was portrayed in the press that way. But I also knew that this history of the war had been marginalized to a great extent, so that In the histories that began to emerge in the late 70s and through the 80s and 90s and up till today, most of them have condensed, you know, whatever history of Vietnamese civilian suffering existed and whatever history of atrocities was out there into the My Lai massacre. So I had an idea that this story had been told during the war, but I knew that it had really been erased from the latter-day histories in many respects.
My guest is Nick Terse. He's a journalist, historian, and author of a new book. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. We would like to hear from Vietnam veterans. If you're out there and have a question or comment for Nick on this topic, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page as well. I want to get back to the idea that the archivist brought up, Nick, whether or not post-traumatic stress disorder could have been caused by witnessing war crimes, these atrocities. And there's always been a feeling about Vietnam vets. A lot of them came back very damaged, and a lot of people have wondered why. Is there any sense, any connection, any correlation between what you discovered in that Vietnam War Crimes Working Group file and what we've seen return from Vietnam?
Well, the records that I found, I wasn't able to, or I should say my boss at the time wasn't able to use in our research because they aren't systematic in the ways that the epidemiologists require, because of the fact that that war crimes are generally covered up, they're kept secret. But the anecdotal evidence that I've seen indicates that witnessing what's called in the literature harm to others or harm to civilians is highly correlated with PTSD. And I can tell you from my own experience, you know, I interviewed, you know, more than 100 veterans in putting together this book, that, you know, these experiences really, you know, stuck with the veterans that I talked to, some of them I seem to block out things, but it always was sort of lingering there. And others told me that they thought of you know, what they had witnessed or what they had done in Vietnam on an almost daily basis. Things that seemed quite normal at the time had plagued them, you know, in the years since.
What do we know about the death toll of civilians in during the Vietnam War at the hands of American troops?
Well, we'll never know exactly how many Vietnamese civilians died in the war, but the best estimates that we have indicate that about 2 million civilians were killed. Add to that about 5.3 million civilian wounded. U.S. government estimates were about 11 million Vietnamese made refugees during the war, and then as many as 4 million Vietnamese exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. So you have suffering on an almost unimaginable scale in Vietnam. At least it was almost unimaginable to me, even after I'd done significant research on the topic. And it was really only after I first reported from Vietnam that I began to truly understand what the scale of the suffering there was.
There was just a little nugget in your book that I read, but it intrigued me that Vietnamese have, what would I call them? They note the massacres at memorials across the country. They're kind of scattered across the country. Can you tell us a little bit about how Vietnamese remember these and this experience?
Sure. The Vietnamese people have a set of spiritual beliefs that regard, you know, those killed in massacre or those killed in war. It's a bad death. In a way that a normal death isn't. It's the idea is a death in the street. If you die outside of your home in these traumatic circumstances, it can cause the belief is a great deal of spiritual pain to the person who died. They're left in some sort of shadow land between the land of the living and the land of the dead. The idea is that you're something like a wandering ghost. And this causes a great deal of psychological stress to your family. What they're required to do is to acknowledge your death and make you have to make offerings to the dead and try and put these people, these wandering ghosts, at peace. So there's a particular set of beliefs around this, and you know at the village level or the hamlet level. There are monuments that are put up for war dead who died in these specific ways, like massacres, like atypical murders. Mm-hmm. And these are set off from things like people who died during bombing or shelling. It's regarded in a somewhat different way. And this is all very different from the way that the Vietnamese government, at least as I understand it, regards the war. They have a narrative that really doesn't have a place for civilians. There's an idea of a heroic revolutionary struggle that everyone was involved in, and civilians are kind of lumped into this. But it's only at the hamlet or village level that there are really memorials for those who died in smaller scale massacres. There's a national monument at My Lai, but it's very atypical.
How did the media miss the litany of atrocities that you uncovered in your research? Because as you pointed out in your book, there were reports of this. There were some organizations, some news outlets that were reporting it, and there were reporters, journalists who were trying to get the word out. But the newspapers and the television and radio didn't pick it up.
Yeah, there are a lot of threads to this. You know, in one respect, the story was being told. You know, prior to My Lai, there was an organization that looked into this, and what they found was more than 3,000 articles in mainstream publications that detailed U.S. violations of the laws of war. But in most cases, these accounts didn't identify the violations as war crimes. They weren't listed as atrocities. There was no context provided to say, you know, if it was an account of torture, water torture that was going on in Vietnam. It didn't say something like, these are the same crimes that Japanese war criminals were hung for after World War II. It was really just chalked up to, you know, this is just how the war in Vietnam is fought. So, you know, when these articles appeared, people didn't, understand that what they were reading a lot of time was a war crime. And, another problem was, you know, there was a lot of death in the countryside, and reporters saw this, but, you know, some of them that I've talked to, and if you read their memoirs and accounts, they say that, if they brought a story to their local bureau chief and said there are civilians being killed in the countryside, it would kind of be, you know, waved off. You know, this is, you know, what's the news? This was well known on some level. But if you sent a story like this over the wire back to the states, the stateside editors were very reluctant to tell these stories. It wasn't part of the narrative. It wasn't it wasn't something that they were very interested in talking about. And there was also on another level not a lot of scrutiny going on. You know, you mentioned the My Lai massacre, where there were 500 civilians killed over a period of 4 hours. This was reported to the world basically through rewrites of U.S. military press releases as a great U.S. victory. 128 enemy troops killed at the cost of no U.S. lives. If anyone had looked into it, they would have also seen that there were only 3 or 4 weapons that were accounted for after this so-called battle. I mean, it was such a lopsided, what they call a kill ratio, and such a lopsided weapons to enemy dead, that someone, you know, there should have been red flags that went up. But instead, this was just, reported, you know, a few pages in the New York Times and other major papers. And it took, even though there were hundreds of foreign reporters, many American reporters in Vietnam at the time, it took a stateside reporter, Seymour Hersh, to blow the lid off My Lai.
We will talk more about My Lai. We'll talk more about how My Lai fell into a policy in Vietnam, among many, many other atrocities. When we return to our interview with Nick Terse, he's a journalist, historian, and author of a new book. We're talking about that now. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This week, join NPR's science correspondent Joe Pelka when he will be in Columbus to lead a discussion on personalized genomics, a science that can predict health conditions based on your genes. The field has the potential to revolutionize healthcare delivery, but raises concerns about privacy and discrimination. This free event and reception is Thursday, January 31st, at 4:30 at WOSU at COSI. RSVP at healthscienceforum.com. And it's 41 degrees in downtown Columbus. Rain today, mainly before 1 o'clock this afternoon, and a high of 49. A chance of rain tonight, and steady temperatures right around 49 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
You've probably heard of Mi Lai, the atrocity in which U.S. troops during the Vietnam War slaughtered some 500 civilians within a matter of a few hours. But that was just one example of a litany of atrocities that occurred during the Vietnam War at the hands of U.S. troops. Joining me now is Nick Turse. He's written about this litany in his new book. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. If you have a question or comment for Nick, give us a call, 614-292-8513. The same man who brought to light My Lai, Ron Ridenour, he also tried at that time to get the point across that My Lai was an operation, not an aberration. This was at the very outset he was trying to get that point across. What happened? What was he saying, and why wasn't it heard?
Well, you know, Ron Ridenour had seen atrocities up close and personal in Vietnam, and then he happened upon My Lai. He wasn't there, mm-hmm. but he heard about it from a number of other fellow troops who had served there, and he put the story of it together and got an investigation launched. But from the outset, as you said, he was saying that this was standard operating procedure, SOP, as they called it in Vietnam, that civilians were being killed on a regular basis. But the U.S. military took a line that My Lai was an isolated incident, that the troops that carried it out were so-called bad apples, and they put together a concerted effort to tell the story. And when they did, their own investigations showed this wasn't the case, and I think it really frightened them. They thought that they would find that this was an aberrant unit, that it was made up of sort of the dregs of the army. But when they looked, they found that it was really a cross section of American youth, and it was a little different than any other unit that served in Vietnam. They put together a major panel to look at My Lai. It was unprecedented in its scope. It's called the Piers Panel, and it was headed by a general, last name Piers. And the idea was to show that My Lai was was a one-off incident. But what scared the military command was when Piers looked closely, he found that on the same day as My Lai, another unit in another village at the exact same time carried out another massacre. We'll never know how many people were killed at My Kay, but somewhere in the realm of 60 to 155, depending on the different American accounts of how many were killed there. So this created a tremendous it was seen as a tremendous problem and a powder keg that could explode. So because of this, in the wake of the My Lai investigation, General William Westmoreland, who was the Army Chief of Staff at the time and had been the Supreme U.S. Commander in Vietnam just a couple years before, he put together this Vietnam War Crimes Working Group, the task force that created the records that I found. And what they did was they weren't designed to investigate war crimes, to try and put an end to war crimes, to put new best practices out into the field. It was just basically a public relations outfit, secret. But they were to track all war crimes allegations, and whenever they could, tamp them down. They wanted to make sure the Army was never caught flat-footed again. And then whenever they could, they would bury an investigation. And this happened again and again. The records just showed this.
Where was the percentage in tamping them down versus stopping them?
Well, they never worked at trying to stop atrocities. This task force, and it was made up of a number of colonels working out of the Pentagon, they didn't do anything in the way of trying to figure out why atrocities were happening, what they could do to mitigate them, to end them. It was strictly an operation to track allegations, to make sure that there were point people on hand, to keep the Secretary of Defense and the White House appraised of anything that might bubble up and be another potential My Lai. And you can see a lot of the case files were you could see they're just closed without much investigation going on. They would ask, the commanding officer, the person who would be responsible for the atrocities, did you see this? And when that officer would say no, it would be used as a pretext to close it. Sometimes they carried out, very detailed investigations. Some of these were, phone book sized or several phone book sized size case folders. They were, rigorously investigated. But even if they would come to the conclusion that, current soldiers, active duty personnel could be prosecuted, they would take no action, and the files would just be buried away. So it's, you can, when you look at these records, you really see a pervasive use of this task force to close down investigations whenever possible.
Tell us about how the massacres, the atrocities, were probably or certainly the outcome of policy in how the war, such as it was fought in Vietnam.
Sure. When I started this project, I was really just looking at these particular records of the War Crimes Working Group and these, you might call them micro-level atrocities, sort of face-to-face atrocities. And, when I went to Vietnam for the first time, I went looking for witnesses and survivors to these particular cases. And in many cases, I was able to find people. But I would go looking to talk about this one specific spasm of violence. But what I noticed the Vietnamese were telling me was what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and shells and helicopter gunships, and how they had to negotiate their lives around the American way of war. I quickly understood that this was really the story that that I wanted to tell. It was the one that I didn't see in the most history books. And this is the way that most Vietnamese were killed. I mentioned 2 million civilian dead, more than 5 million civilian wounded. Most of these people were not killed or wounded by, American patrols or killed in My Lai-style massacres. They were killed as a result of almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. So this is really deliberate policies dictated at the highest levels of the U.S. military. And this is so it's not just a few random massacres or discrete strings of atrocities, but something on the order of thousands of days of relentless misery for the Vietnamese as a result of American policies, just the way the war was fought.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Nick Terse. He's the author of a new book. It's called Kill Anything That Moves: The Real American War in Vietnam. Troops and their leaders were rewarded for high body counts.
That's right. The U.S., because they were not fighting a World War I style war where you had, one army facing off against the other army. They're fighting against a guerrilla force who was radically outgunned. So the Vietnamese guerrillas were not going to stand toe-to-toe against the Americans and try and just slug it out with firepower. They didn't have the firepower to do so. So they generally fought through hit-and-run tactics, ambushes, snipers, booby traps. And, as a result, the U.S. was looking for some sort of metric to show that it was winning the war. And it seized upon body count, which it had adopted during the second half of the Korean War. And the idea was that you could kill your way to victory, that you would kill enough enemy troops so that you'd be killing more than they could put in the field. And eventually the enemy would just sue for peace because they would see the war as, as unwinnable. And the idea was they would view the war as sort of a ledger sheet with debits and credits, which is much the way that the U.S. Pentagon thought about the war. It was headed by Robert McNamara. He had run Ford Motor Company before he took over the Pentagon, and he saw war as something that could be rationally managed, and he thought his enemies would look at the war in the same way, even though they were saw themselves a nationalist movement, which was carry on an anti-colonial struggle, the same one that they'd fought against the French a few years before. So the idea with the attrition strategy was that you had to maintain a high body count. You had to pile up Vietnamese bodies. And troops in the field learned pretty quickly that their commanders weren't discerning about what bodies were turned in. As I mentioned at My Lai, 500 civilians dead. They called it in as 128 enemy killed. Even though they didn't have, you know, anywhere near a commensurate number of weapons, the commanders didn't ask any questions. There were Vietnamese bodies there. They were able to call it in, and this was just accepted. And this made it very easy for U.S. troops to pull the trigger. You could shoot first because you knew that no one was going to ask questions later.
How were the troops prepared to do this? How were they taught to do this?
Well, troops were really given lackluster training prior to Vietnam. They weren't schooled in any of the intricacies of guerrilla warfare. They weren't really taught about how to fight a war amidst the civilian population. Instead, they were generally told that all Vietnamese were potential enemies, that women might be constructing or setting booby traps, that children might have a grenade on them. They were often told that, that anyone in so-called black pajamas, and this was the standard clothing in the Vietnamese countryside that farmers and guerrillas wore. It was loose-fitting black clothing. And they were told that pretty much anyone in black pajamas was the enemy. And on top of this, there was a pervasive form of racism and dehumanization that really suffused boot camp, basic training. And this held that the Vietnamese weren't real people, that they were subhuman, mere gooks who could be killed or abused at will. And a lot of the veterans that I talked to told me that, you know, from the moment they got to boot camp, they were told, don't call them Vietnamese. You call them gooks or dinks, slants, slopes, anything to take away their humanity, anything to make it easier to pull that trigger. And this really had disastrous consequences for the Vietnamese in the countryside.
If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Michael. He writes, several years ago, the husband of a colleague of mine, a Vietnam veteran, discovered for the first time that I was also a veteran of that era. We were at a party, and he had been drinking heavily because it was the anniversary of his discharge from the Army, an anniversary that always made him quite morose. He talked to me that evening for several hours with great rage about his anger at the political and military leaders of that time. The following morning, I learned that he had killed himself that night with a self-inflicted gunshot. On reflecting, I realized that he had never described a specific event of his war experience, and I wondered whether he had witnessed war atrocities that had later come to haunt him. Of course, I'll never know.
It's just an exceptionally sad and moving story, and I've heard others like it before. I mean, it's not it's not uncommon, or an isolated incident in any way. You know, I've, as I said, I spoke to many veterans with this, and I do know that these events have really stuck with them. One thing that I didn't mention when I was talking about boot camp was that, you know, the soldiers that fought in Vietnam, it's important to remember, they were really really just boys at the time.
18, 19,
20 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was the standard age for an infantryman. So, a lot of these guys weren't, this was their first time out of a small southern town or a northern inner city. I mean, this was a war that was really fought by working class youth in many respects, and they were very young and thrown into often untenable situations. You know, I remember talking to one veteran. It's a story that always sticks in my head. You know, I was talking to him, you know, when I'm working on this book. We were talking for several hours about his war experiences, and he was a very infectious laugh. He quieted down, and he said, I want to tell you about this one village we went through. And his patrol was burning down this village, which was really standard operating procedure for U.S. troops. This was how they were trying to break bond between guerrillas and the Vietnamese in the countryside. They would just burn down villages and try and force the people into refugee centers or the slums that began to ring most Vietnamese towns and cities at the time, drive them out of the countryside and isolate the guerrillas. So they were burning down a village, and he said a woman came up and grabbed this GI on the arm and was yelling at him, obviously because her home was being burned down. Mm-hmm. And he said that he watched as this GI pushed the woman away and then took the butt of his rifle and hit her squarely in the nose, broke her nose. There was blood everywhere. She was screaming. And he said this guy just walked away laughing. And, you know, he let that story kind of settle over me. And then he said, you know that I was that GI. And, you know, I kind of knew that's where the story was going. And but I still had such a tough time linking up, you know, the man that I was talking to with his 19-year-old self. And he told me that he had the same problem, that he couldn't imagine how he had done that. He couldn't believe that he'd walked away laughing. But he said that experience and others in Vietnam had just stuck with him. And even though it seemed routine at the time, you know, every day since he thought about, how could I have done that? You know, why did I do that? And he could never come up with the answers, and it haunted him ever since.
You know, it's interesting because I remember reading that in the book, but I don't remember reading that it was him. That kind of didn't stick with me.
Yeah.
But the butt of the gun in the woman's face did. It's interesting. We'll take a quick call here. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, David.
Oh, hello.
Hi, David.
Hi. I'm not a Vietnam veteran. My father served in Vietnam in 1965. He was a Green Beret, 82nd Airborne, what they called advisors. My brother served, too, in the Navy in Vietnam. I think what we seem to be missing here is, like, the My Lai Massacre, over 500 people killed. One person did 9 months of house arrest. There were helicopter pilots that received the Silver Cross for protecting the citizens of My Lai from American troops. Mm-hmm. We seem to be missed that we don't want to believe that our troops can do these things, just like we don't want to believe, you know, that when we do torture, it's not torture. This is what we want to believe as Americans, that our troops do no wrong and that there can be no orders, you know, that can negate that.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make that statement, and
okay.
That's really all I have to say.
All right, David, thank you.
Okay, sure, bye.
I appreciate that call. You know, I think he's right in a lot of respects, that this is it's not the narrative of the war that that the government's ever wanted to tell, and it's not one that most Americans have wanted to hear. I mean, it's a very unpleasant subject, and it's not something that that people want to think about American troops. But I do think it is exceptionally important, especially if America is involved in almost constant warfare, that Americans do have an idea of what war is really about. If we're called upon to send our brothers and sisters and sons and daughters to war, I think it's important to have a clear idea of what that means for them and what it means for the sons and daughters of people overseas.
I'm talking with Nick Turse. He's a journalist, historian, and author of a new book. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. We'll return in just a minute. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the U.S. Department of Education is telling schools they must include students with disabilities in sports. How will that work? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins. And calling all language lovers, Grammar Girl joins the show to answer your questions. That's from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. It's 41 degrees with some light rain. Expect showers off and on throughout the day, mostly before 1 o'clock this afternoon, and a high of 49. There's still a chance of rain for tonight. We'll have steady temperatures right around 48 degrees overnight. And then a slight chance of rain on Tuesday and a warmer day, a high of 60 degrees. A chance of rain again for Tuesday night, a low of 51. Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, performing with the Columbus Youth Jazz Orchestra in Ragtime Blues Beyond, a short history of jazz, with guest saxophonist Tina Fuller and drummer Lewis Nash, showcasing over 100 years of jazz February 7th through the 10th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Nick Terse. He's written a new book. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The rules of war were not followed. That became clear with My Lai. They didn't even appear to be understood. How they are taught now has changed since then, but it didn't seem to make any difference during the Vietnam War. Has it made any difference going forward?
Well, I think that it has. I've studied today's wars fairly closely, and I have to say I don't think the killing of civilians by U.S. forces today is anything near the scale of the carnage that was seen in Vietnam. I think specifically the ways that artillery and air power are used, I think they're radically different. But that said, civilians still die on a regular basis in our war zones, be it Iraq or Afghanistan, and many of them due to violence set off by America's invasions and occupations and the resulting civil strife. But others are killed directly, still by U.S. bombing, helicopter gunships, troops on the ground, and still more are wounded. And I don't think we have... We still don't have had good numbers on the civilian toll. So it's even though different NGOs and the UN have made their best efforts, I still don't think we have a clear picture of it. So it's hard to know for certain what the magnitude of the suffering has been as a result of these wars. And I'm afraid if history is any guide, it could be decades before someone's able to put together the real story of these wars for civilians. Let alone the story of the semi-covert campaigns in places like Pakistan and Yemen, where it's even tougher to get information on exactly how many civilians are dying.
Rod in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rod.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for letting me speak. I was part of that generation. I was in the second draft lottery, the one for people born in 1951. So this is a topic, that I'm interested in. As far as I know, a previous caller sort of alluded to it. The only person that was ever convicted for war crimes in the My Lai massacre was Lieutenant William Calley. And my question is, it doesn't seem like it went very far up the chain of command, and I was wondering if Lieutenant Calley was scapegoated and perhaps should higher officers have been prosecuted.
Well, I don't think Calley is a classic scapegoat in the sense that Calley did have a great deal of blood on his hands and was responsible for killing a lot of people at My Lai. He was charged with killing over 100 and convicted of killing several dozen. He certainly had blood on his hands, but Callie was, really they settled on him as the person who would bear the burden for this. 500 civilians were not killed by one man. There were more than 100 American troops in My Lai that day, and dozens of them took part in this massacre. Then there were there was Callie's commander, Captain Medina, who was also he was charged in connection with My Lai, and his troops said that he gave orders to kill anything that moves, was what one of them had said. Others heard different variations of this, but they said that it was very clear they were to go into My Lai and kill everyone there. There were colonels who were flying overhead in helicopters who saw the piles of bodies. They knew that large numbers of civilians had to have been killed there, but they covered this up, and there were generals above them who had this knowledge. The Peers Commission that I mentioned earlier, they found that that there could be dozens and dozens of men charged in connection with My Lai, but it was all put on Callie's shoulders. And even Callie was, as an earlier caller mentioned, he only served mostly house arrest for a period of months. He was pardoned by President Richard Nixon, and he got it was really just a slap on the wrist, and that was it for My Lai.
Tony in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Thank you, madam. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. You're a Vietnam vet.
No, I'm not a vet. Several of my closest friends were vets. Unfortunately, I was able to escape Vietnam through college and so forth. So on. But anyway, as I said previously, I have a real dear friend. His name was Steve. We don't give out no last names. He died. He stepped on a clayborn mine. But anyway, I got letters from him how the objective, not only in My Lai, all of Vietnam, they're saying was to destroy, kill, rape, and plunder. But even prior to that, he had told me that he would die in Vietnam because he had a sergeant that just designated all the black troops that came in to go to Vietnam with this objective. And he told me he stayed with me on his vacation before he went to Vietnam. He said, I won't make it back because he didn't have adequate training. This is the United States. And as I've gone through the years, it's hard to fathom, but it's so true.
Nick, did you see any evidence of what Tony refers to in terms of African-Americans being targeted as the particularly for this kind of duty?
Well, this is something that Martin Luther King remarked on during the war, that African-Americans were shuttled into combat roles at an elevated rate compared to their the distribution in the population. Mm-hmm. That there was that they were pushed into ground infantry at a higher rate, and this was the military looked at this, and I'd seen this in the records that you can see it earlier in the war, and then after King brought this up, there were efforts taken to get that percentage down to what would be a normal distribution, but there was perceivable channeling of African Americans into the combat arms.
And there were others who were worried they wouldn't make it back because they protested the atrocities and were warned not to do anything about it.
That's right. There's one veteran that I pay special attention to in the book, one who really affected my life, named Jamie Henry, who was drafted and went to Vietnam as a medic, and he was a very good one. He saved a lot of American lives, but he was really shocked by what he saw in Vietnam. On his first day in the field, he watched the point man, the lead man of his patrol, molest a young girl, and he thought to himself, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place. A young boy executed for no reason, an old man used for target practice, a prisoner thrown off a cliff, a man held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. But when he spoke up about brutality, his life was threatened. And even his friends came up to him, and they said, look, you better keep your mouth shut or you're going to get a bullet in the back during a firefight and no one's going to be any the wiser. So this was a real fear for whistleblowers in Vietnam and one that that Jamie Henry took seriously.
Tony, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. Thank you,
Tony.
Thank
you so much.
Yep.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye. Dick in Fairfield Beach. Welcome to the show, Dick.
Hi. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. I haven't talked for a little few minutes here.
Okay.
Just for the record, I was a draft resister at the time. The stories he's recounting, I knew many, many veterans. The stories he's recounting at the time were common at the time. And some even brought back pictures, but they kept them to themselves pretty much. But they shared some with me. I was staying in a flop house, $15 a week on St. Charles Avenue. And there was this tall guy originally from St. Thomas, who was an ex-Marine. And he was drinking himself mostly comatose every day. I gave him a place to stay for a couple weeks. And he would come out of comatose, and he would be reliving the war. And he was mowing down villagers. It was as frightening a thing as you can imagine. With all this rage, and I would try to make myself as invisible as possible. But we tried to work this out over the next few weeks. And according to what he said, it was standard operating procedure. And at times, a small village, as a small platoon, they would go wipe out the village, and then they would disappear into the jungle. And it can't be the only person. I can't be the only one who's run into this.
Right.
There must be many, many others at the time. Dealing with just such PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Dick, thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm.
Take care.
There are, as I did research in Vietnam, a lot of times I would be searching for one particular massacre, but I would only have a general location to go by, and. You know, when I went, I thought I'd be looking for a needle in a haystack. And really what it turned out to be in a lot of cases was that I was looking for one particular needle in a haystack of needles, that there were more massacres than I could imagine. And trying to find the right one often was it was very difficult. So this is I think it's, along the lines of what the last caller was talking about, that, we've been told that there's really one big massacre, My Lai, and that's the one that U.S. troops went in and destroyed this village. But it was more common than we were led to believe.
An email from George in Clintonville. He says, a lot of vets, like my father, seem to think the war was winnable, blaming strategy, McNamara, etc. Does the author have any insight about how the war might have been fought differently, or what were the major shortcomings of how the war was fought as it was?
Well, the military has clung to the idea that they fought with one hand tied behind their back. That if they had just been allowed to have their hands freed and fight the way they wanted to, that somehow politicians were restricting them. But if you really look at the history of the war, and I try and lay it out in the book, other than a full scale invasion of North Vietnam, which was politically untenable. One, there was a fear that China would enter the conflict and it'd be a repeat of the Korean War. There just was no appetite for the type of draft that would be necessary to have, 1 to 2 million men on the ground in Vietnam, or the use of nuclear weapons, which was also politically off the table. Other than that, there wasn't really any type of firepower that the U.S. had that it didn't unleash on Vietnam. Vietnam was hit with more ordnance than was dropped during the entirety of World War II, both sides, the Axis and the Allies. This one tiny country was just pummeled with high explosive ordnance, with new types of weapons like cluster munitions, with incendiary agents like napalm and white phosphorus. It's just a tremendous amount of firepower. And the U.S. did everything it really could to win this war through the use of heavy firepower, and it just wasn't possible. They were never able to win over the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese were fighting a war of liberation, as they saw it. This was an anti-colonial struggle. They'd fought the Japanese during World War II. They fought the French and beaten them, and they just saw that the United States' effort in Vietnam is a continuation of this. And they were willing to fight however long it took. There really was, I can't see a way that the war was ever winnable for the U.S.
John in Columbus, you are a veteran of the Vietnam War?
Yes, I was.
Thanks for your call.
There's no problem. Yeah, after hearing all this, it was, I don't know how to explain it, it was the roughest probably 5 years of my life. Everything that he's confirmed, I can confirm pretty much everything he's been talking about. I mean, I think everybody did something they didn't want to do there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wanting to say that I'm glad somebody actually wrote a book and actually is telling what's really going on, what actually happened. I mean, I still have nightmares about what happened, and gosh, I don't know how to explain it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I wanted to call and say is I'm glad somebody finally wrote a book that's actually telling the truth about everything.
Thanks for your call, John. We appreciate it. Take care.
No problem. Thank you.
I really appreciate the call, and I couldn't have written this book without the assistance of so many American veterans who really they said the same thing, that they really wanted this story to be told, that that a lot of them felt they couldn't tell this after the war, and people didn't want to hear it, but that they were glad that this was being told, that the real history of the war would finally get out.
Nick Tursch, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I've been talking with Nick Tursch. He's a journalist, historian, and author of a new book. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.